Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There's a building here in Manhattan on West 23rd Street, a famous building. It's famous for being a hotel, but it, too, has been other things.
I don't mean to suggest that I loved you the best. I can't keep track of each fallen robin. I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. That's all, I don't even think of you that often.
This song, Chelsea Hotel No. 2 by Leonard Cohen, describes an encounter in Manhattan's legendary Chelsea Hotel. It wasn't just a place to rent a room for the night. It was an actual home for artists of all stripes. Painters, poets, writers, composers, folkies, and punks. They all lived and worked there over the years. The Chelsea Hotel has stamped its mark on lots of different types of American art, and it has also produced more than its fair share of strange stories. So many, in fact, that it's hard to believe it all happened under one roof, or that all those stories could be collected in one book. But the author Cheryl Tippins took on that ambitious task, and the result is Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. Cheryl Tippins joins me now in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Hi, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk for a moment about this Leonard Cohen song, because it is sort of a good case study of how the Chelsea Hotel sort of weaves itself into the fabric of popular culture.
Yes, it's a good case study. And of course, it's the first song everyone thinks of when they think of musicians at the Chelsea Hotel. I think Leonard Cohen, aside from his tryst there with Janis Joplin, which the song is about, as mm-hmm. he's always admitted, I think he's an interesting character to look at in terms of the Chelsea, because he was one of the first who was attracted to the Chelsea's musical culture. Others were attracted for its structure in terms of serving the artists. For example, mm-hmm. when Bob Dylan got there, he liked its privacy.
It had soundproof walls. I mean, it was built that way to provide that sort of privacy.
Yes, it was built for creative life. It's wonderful for musicians. They've been attracted to it from the beginning.
So tell the story. There's this, the story of Leonard Cohen, how he first meets Janis Joplin in the hotel.
So they met in an elevator, and of course, both were very flirty types of people, and so of course, they struck up a conversation, and she said, "Are you Kris Kristofferson?" Because she was hoping to meet him at the Chelsea. And he thought for a second. He said, "Yes, my dear, I am."
And it's your lucky day, because I am, in fact, Kris Kristofferson, says Leonard Cohen.
If that's who you want to meet, that's who I'll be.
And the result was this
one-night
tryst.
Yes,
that they had. Turns into this classic song from Leonard Cohen called Chelsea Hotel No. 2.
Those were the reason that was New York. We were running for the money and the flesh. And that was called love for the workers in song. Probably still is for those of them left. Yeah, but you got away. Didn't you, babe? You just turn your back on the crowd. You got a way I never once heard you say. I need you. I don't need you. I need you. I don't need you. And all of them jiving around. I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel.
That is Leonard Cohen singing about a night spent with Janis Joplin in the Chelsea Hotel. The song is Chelsea Hotel No. 2. The Chelsea Hotel is the subject of Cheryl Tippins' new book, Inside the Dream Palace. So who else? I mean, there's a panoply of people who lived in the Chelsea Hotel. I mean, there are many people who know that, you know, Dylan was there, and O. Henry was there, and Thomas Wolfe and Dylan Thomas, and you know, all these people, and Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe, and all these folks were there. What I didn't know was that this was not an accident. This was sort of the idea behind the building itself.
Yeah, that was why I wrote the book, because these stories of Bob Dylan and Lou Reed and Janis Joplin have been told many times, but what fascinated me was why they happened there, what made this building what it was. And what I discovered was that it had been created intentionally to foster a creative life and to sort of jumpstart an indigenous American culture in New York at a time in the Gilded Age when everyone was only interested in European art,
right.
Music, paintings, books, etc.
So you had the Hudson School painters, you had the big actresses and actors of the day.
Yes, and realism was the movement that that inhabited the Chelsea from the first generation. And the reason there was Steele McKay, the Frohman brothers, Franklin Sargent were all involved in a theater that the Philip Hubert, the architect of the Chelsea, created alongside the Chelsea, and he also created the Lyceum's drama school, which became the American Academy of Dramatic Arts later. Mm. So it was the first professional drama school in New York that succeeded. So all of these people were very passionate about highlighting specific aspects of everyday American life as opposed to European dramas and farces and stuff like that. So it was the painters, it was the writers, William Dean Howells, Antonin Dvorak, when he came to head the National Conservatory of Music,
really?
Had students at the Chelsea. Mm-hmm. But it would take a few generations for these seeds that were planted to start to grow.
So from the beginning, you have not just artists, but this kind of communal / utopian aspect to it where, you know, Hubert, the architect, gives apartments to the people who built the hotel. And so you have electricians and plumbers living in the same building as these artists and theater people.
Yes. The architect, Philip Hubert's father, had been an architect for the utopian French philosopher Charles Fourier. And the basis of this philosophy was that the more diverse a society is, the richer it is.
Mm-hmm.
So Philip Hubert had brought the cooperative, which is also a Fourierist idea, that everyone share the expenses of living so that they can free themselves up to live creatively and they don't have to work as much.
Right.
You know, making money.
Yeah, yeah.
And
So the landlord, who for many years was Stanley Bard, and obviously there were some before him, and we can talk a little bit later about who came after, but Stanley Bard, so he eventually, after some initial, it seems, reluctance, takes on the role of basically curating a hotel full of artists.
Stanley Bard himself was a kind of artist, and he was trained by the artists in the hotel. He went to school in New York. He'd been in the military for a while, and it was the Mad Men era, you know, late 50s. All of his friends were making lots of money in the high-rise office buildings, and he wanted to make a lot of money, too. But his father, who co-owned the hotel and managed it at the time, David Bard, insisted that he come and be his assistant for almost no money, and Stanley really resented it. But artists like Claude and Christo were living there at the time, and other French pop artists were just coming in, the Nouveau Realist artists, and sort of inculcated him into the culture of the Chelsea. And the people who lived at the hotel, they liked Stanley. He was a sweet guy. They started inviting him to their art openings and to their parties and to their performances. And he fell in love with his tenants, with the residents there, and became more of a booster of the residents of the Chelsea than anyone ever had been before or since.
So we're speaking with Cheryl Tippins, author of the new book, Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. So Stanley Bard is running the place from what, maybe the mid-50s, late 50s?
Late 50s through about 2000.
So past the turn of the century.
Yeah.
During which time, a lot of the names that we know and associate with the Chelsea Hotel are there. So Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan comes on the scene because he's got a secret, right?
Well, he was in love with Sarah, Lowndes, who had a child. And so the Chelsea was actually at the time a good place to live if you had a child. There were lots of children living there. Arthur Miller's daughter, Rebecca Miller, was there a lot and so on. And so Dylan moved there to be near and then with Sarah. And he was a very private person. There were, according to Stanley Bard, he was practically invisible, slipping in and out, and was very well-mannered, Stanley said, a very polite young boy. So
we're talking about like 1965.
Yeah, this is about 65.
And they get secretly married.
Yes.
He's really trying. He's become incredibly famous, and he's trying to keep his family out
yes.
of the limelight. Could he do that at the Chelsea Hotel?
He could do it at the hotel. There was, of course, gossip, especially romantic gossip, swirling around him all the time, which, of course, could be very irritating. Of course, you know, there were all the rumors that he and Edie Sedgwick were having an affair and so on. But at the Chelsea, there are certain rules of life there that have been laid down or developed over the decades. And one of them is you don't bother people during work hours. You don't hit somebody up for a job or for a connection. If you want to see someone, you can call them through the switchboard. You can leave a note at the front desk. You don't just barge in on people. And so he was able to enjoy a kind of family life and a private creative life there and was respected for that there.
At a time when he probably couldn't get that outside the front door.
Exactly.
Yeah. So in this cultural milieu at the Chelsea Hotel, Bob Dylan starts work on his album Blonde on Blonde, which would come out in 1966 and features a number of songs that are sort of written to or about Sarah, who was his secret wife at the time.
Sad-eyed lady of the lowlands, where the sad-eyed prophet says that no man comes. My way. Should I put them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
Bob Dylan, Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, written for his wife Sarah, from the album Blonde on Blonde, an album begun while Dylan was living in the Chelsea Hotel, where he had moved to be with Sarah. One of the many tales told in Cheryl Tippin's new book, Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. So Blonde on Blonde comes out. Andy Warhol does his Chelsea Girls Hotel. And we've mentioned the Leonard Cohen song, Chelsea Hotel Number 2. Eventually, the hotel becomes famous itself, not just for the people in it, but as a kind of thing in our cultural consciousness.
Yes, and as I mentioned before, I think Leonard Cohen was the first musician who then became famous who came to the hotel because it was the place where Bob Dylan had been. It was the place to be if you were a musician, also for the privacy, for the culture. But he wanted to get to know the other musicians. He was breaking into this new industry.
Now, were they able to walk that line? Were they able to be a famous art place, you know, and still be able to maintain the kind of rules of privacy, the rules of contact and non-contact that you were talking about?
Yes, it got more difficult. You know, when Patti Smith came in, she found the same sort of, you know, help from her neighbors, the same sort of respect for herself, even though she hadn't yet accomplished anything. You could be an artist before you were an artist at the Chelsea, and that's an important part of becoming one. To be taken seriously. And so throughout the history of New York, that's been very difficult to find.
Well, Patti Smith writes a lot about her years at
yes.
the Chelsea Hotel in her
yes.
memoir, Just
Thankfully
Kids.
For me.
And at one point, she writes a poem in the lobby of the Chelsea Hotel, which turns into this song.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild cord on my sleeve, thick,
heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me, me. People say beware, but I don't care. The words are just rules and regulations to me, me.
That is Gloria from Patti Smith. And boy, she certainly became someone when that record came out. But at the Chelsea Hotel, she was an artist even before anybody else knew it.
Yes, she was. And one thing that listening to this, these songs in sequence, you can hear that first realist impulse moving all the way through the music from one song to the next. And she picked, it's just fascinating to me to watch it develop and watch it grow generation after generation.
We're speaking with Cheryl Tippins, who is the author of Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. This is not the first book you've written about a New York City building that housed an incredible concentration of artists. February House was about the building in Brooklyn Heights, now gone.
Yes.
Where W.H. Auden and Benjamin Britten and Paul Bowles and Carson McCullers and Gypsy Rose Lee all lived under one roof.
Yes, roommates.
So these things do happen from time to time.
Yes, they do. And this one has lasted 130 years so far and is probably the largest artist community ever.
And it included not just these musicians we're talking about, but filmmakers and poets and authors and dancers and classical composers. Now, you know, people who grew up in the 50s, 60s, maybe even 70s and 80s will be familiar with George Kleinsinger, maybe not his name, but his piece Tubby the Tuba,
yes.
A kind of Peter and the Wolfish thing.
Yes.
So I just always assumed a classical composer, probably, you know, led a quiet, sedate life. Reading your book, this guy was a maniac.
Well, he was one of my favorites. He turned his rooftop apartment into a jungle. He loved animals and he loved exotic plants. And he had huge trees shipped in and exotic birds and an 8-foot python and a tortoise that would dance when he played his piano.
Yes. All kinds of animals that were probably illegal to have.
Yes, and the maids, the cleaning women, would complain because they'd make the bed and there would be a python on in it, and you know, and Walter Cronkite visited once and was bitten by his monkey, so they had to get rid of the monkey.
And Kleinsinger found that this was not only conducive to his creativity, but to attracting young ladies as
yes.
well. Apparently,
well, who wouldn't come up and see a jungle upstairs? but he loved to have parties, and he loved to perform his music for people, and so it was a big, huge gathering place at the Chelsea.
I got to say, it was one of the big surprises in the book for me that the guy who wrote this piece, this children's favorite, Tubby the Tuba, was one of the wilder denizens of the Chelsea Hotel.
Oh, what lovely music, thought Tubby, and he sighed.
Here, what's the matter, said Peepo the Piccolo.
Oh, said Tubby, every time we do a new piece, you all get such pretty melodies to play, and I never, never a pretty melody.
But people never write pretty melodies for tubas. It just isn't done.
Shh, there's the conductor. First the violins dance their lovely little tune on their strings. Then they cry to the flute, catch! Got it, cry the flute.
A little bit of George Kleinsinger's Tubby the Tuba. Kids who listened to that had no idea what this guy was up to in his rooftop duplex apartment there at the Chelsea Hotel. Cheryl Tippins is with us on Soundcheck. Her book is called Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we have not yet touched on the dark side, and there is a very dark side to the story of the Chelsea Hotel. We've also got live music from the Canadian favorites, the Sadies. They'll be playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio, so stay with us for that. Back in a moment. This is Soundcheck.
J-L-O-I.
out for days in the Chelsea Hotel, writing sad-eyed lady of the lowlands for you. Sarah, oh Sarah, wherever we travel, we'll never apart.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're speaking with author Cheryl Tippins, who's written a new book called Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel, which, as we've learned, was begun in the 1880s with the idea that musicians and artists would have a place to live and work. And it seems, Cheryl, that from the beginning, the fact that artists have fluctuating income and sometimes very little income was taken into account with, like charging rent or things like that.
Yes, I should say it was taken into account from the beginning. I've found letters at the Smithsonian of the artist saying, I can't pay my rent now, which was $47 a month at the time, but I'll catch up in winter. And they were allowed, the cooperative allowed them to do that. So this tradition began then, and it's gone all the way through with Stanley Bard, who was the master of taking a painting in exchange for rent or just letting people slide on the rent. And he used to claim that no artist ever stiffed him. Mm-hmm. That was his claim.
Well, I would imagine that he did pretty well with some of those paintings and poems and things that people gave him in lieu of rent once those people became famous. So there is this utopian aspect to it. But as I sort of alluded to darkly before the break, there is another side to the story of the Chelsea Hotel. And it is a side that for many people, the image is Sid Vicious and his girlfriend Nancy Spungen.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us that story and what that did to the image of the Chelsea Hotel.
Well, the Chelsea, of course, along with the rest of the city, it started to slide quite a bit in the 1970s because of stagflation, the economic situation. And then a lot of drug dealers had already moved in along with the flow of rock and roll bands who were performing at Fillmore East. Stanley Bard had a deal with the owner of Fillmore East to have the band stay at the Chelsea. So they brought their entire entourage, their groupies, but the dealers became a problem in the hotel, and they didn't, when the Fillmore East closed, they didn't leave. They just stayed, and some of the residents themselves even became dealers because it was a great way to support their artwork. Not a lot, but some. So by the time Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen showed up, it was a lot of the punk bands had already been there. Dee Dee Ramone had been there with his girlfriend, Connie Gripp, and it was the place you went. It was just, who else would take the punk musicians? Sid Vicious had just come off a disastrous tour of the United States. The Sex Pistols had disbanded. The tour had been organized for maximum sensationalism, and that's what they got, and it just became too violent, and the whole thing fell apart. But he had made his greatest hit song, My Way, in Paris just before he'd come to New York. So fortunately, he got, or perhaps unfortunately, he got a lot of money for that song. Mm-hmm. And Nancy had decided she was going to be his manager, and they moved into the Chelsea. And as soon as they got their money, they started spending it on drugs and shooting up a lot of heroin, a lot of other kinds of drugs. And, of course, that attracted other people who were interested in selling them and in doing and in partaking. And so they ended up having a fire in their room upstairs. And so Stanley Bard moved them down to the first floor where he hoped to keep an eye on them. And unfortunately, one night, Nancy was murdered. Mm-hmm. And then Sid Vicious was accused of having murdered her.
And then he dies 4 months later himself.
Yes, of an overdose.
The murder was never actually proven, right?
It's interesting because you can see when you trace the records how quickly he was accused, how there
right.
really wasn't very much investigation. It was very convenient to have a Sid Vicious incarcerated.
Right, it's punk musician, drug addict,
it was a good
what
story.
More? It was all over the headlines, and, it put the Chelsea Hotel in the headlines for all the wrong reasons, and then, of course, those headlines spawned the movie called Sid and Nancy. And in this scene from the movie, Gary Oldman, playing Sid Vicious, is recreating the song you were just talking about, Sid Vicious's version of My Way.
Oh, Lord,
That is Gary Oldman channeling Sid Vicious of the Sex Pistols, and Sid Vicious doing the song My Way from the film Sid and Nancy, which, you know, takes all the lurid details of the deaths of Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, the death of Nancy specifically in their room at the Chelsea Hotel. So now, Cheryl, you have, you know, this venerable utopian ideal driven institution that finds itself on screen and in the headlines with an absolute image problem. So what do they do?
It was traumatic not only for the owners, but who felt that they would never, the hotel would never recover, but also for the residents, because no one understood the life inside anymore. It was stereotyped as a punk ghetto. And that was rather, that was how I thought of it, too. I'd moved to New York in 78, a few months before Nancy was murdered. And I kind of, although I'd gone to parties there and I'd seen that Yakov Lind, the playwright, lived there, there was artistic life going on. I didn't think about it very much, but it just seemed like, you know, a flea bag place to me, not a place I'd want to spend a lot of time in. And it wasn't really fair. It wasn't fair to the hotel. It wasn't fair to the residents or to the owner, in a sense, but that's the way it goes sometimes. And then when they had their centennial celebration, they started to get back on their feet. And all the residents came together, and they composed music and choreographed dance and made paintings and wrote poetry and performed. And Joseph Papp from the Public Theater came, and Mayor Koch, and they tried to resurrect the original spirit of the Chelsea. And from then on, it's been a hard slog, but they have been getting more and more back to normal over the decades since.
And the building's been sold. It's got new owners. The future seems to be somewhat uncertain. There's lots of legal stuff happening. What's the current situation?
There has been a spate. The building was sold, and then there were the usual spate of evictions. And under when it was bought by Joseph Chetreat, and now there's been a shift in ownership. There's a new owner, Ed Sheets, who has a great enthusiasm for the history of the building and is trying to design it so that it will continue to work as a place economically mixed and very artistically creative. And it's a hard task because it's also very expensive. And that's always been the case at the Chelsea. It's always been too expensive for its own good, and it's gone bankrupt over and over and over in its history. But, you know, I've worked on this book for 6 years. For 6 years, I've gone to interview and to visit, been invited to dinners at the Chelsea, to parties, and gotten to know the people who live there. And that life continues there, and it's a wonderful life. I feel that I have another extra family there, and they're so kind to one another. It does still foster this sort of creative life so far. Mm. It's now shut down, so you don't have the wonderful blood circulation of tourists coming through all the time, because what artist doesn't like to have an audience? And those people were the audience, telling them every day how wonderful they were to be artists. So, you know, it's sad that that's not there, and the building has been gutted. And that's physically painful. It's viscerally painful to the residents who love the building, who live there. It's very difficult to go through.
But they're still living there.
They're still living there. They're about 80 or 90 people still living there, I believe.
Well, you know, in recent years, Madonna, Ethan Hawke, Rufus Wainwright went through. For his project Poses, he wanted to have that Chelsea Hotel experience, and
right.
he wanted to document that in song. So it does still, in recent times, Rufus was 2001, so relatively recent, we still do hear the echoes of this long tradition of artistic ferment at the Chelsea Hotel. We've been speaking with Cheryl Tippins. She's the author of the new book, Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. It is full of tall tales and surprises. And Cheryl, thank you very much for sharing some of them with us.
Thank you. It was good to be here.
The yellow walls are lined with portraits, and I got my new red fetching leather jacket. All these poses, such beautiful poses, makes any boy feel like picking up roses. There's never been such grave a matter as comparing our new brand name black sunglasses. All these poses, such beautiful poses, makes any boy feel as pretty as princes. The green autumnal parks conducting, and the city streets a wondrous chorus singing. All these poses, oh how can you blame me? Life is a game and true love is a trophy. My head.